Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Nasser Hanna for his take on some of the most clinically relevant recent research data sets in the field. And to do this, he presented several patients from his practice, beginning with a woman with adenocarcinoma who never smoked.
I'm currently seeing a patient who is 65 years old. She is a lifelong never smoker, and 2 years ago, she was diagnosed as having a stage 1 adenocarcinoma of the lung. She underwent a lobectomy and mediastinal lymph node dissection. She had a 1.5 centimeter tumor. It was well differentiated. She recovered uneventfully from her surgery, and her oncologist recommended surveillance and no adjuvant therapy. And she did well for the next couple of years. She had routine surveillance, and she developed this nodule in her mid-scapular area. Saw her doc about it. It had grown slowly over the course of about 6 months' time. They eventually got a biopsy of it, and it showed a well-differentiated adenocarcinoma. It looked identical to her lung primary from 2 years previous. They did further imaging studies, and the only thing that was abnormal apart from that nodule was a small 1.5 centimeter nodule in her lung. So she came to see me about therapeutic options. Since she's a never smoker and she has an adenocarcinoma, I suggested she get testing for EGFR and ALK. Unfortunately, she had neither of those gene mutations. And now she's asking me what she should do. She feels well. She's a healthy lady otherwise. Her performance status is zero. She's lost no weight. Her appetite is outstanding. And this is a patient, I think, in whom it's challenging to know what to do.
So let's go over a couple points here. First, is there any role for looking at KRAS in her tumor right now?
Well, I think there are two reasons to consider that. One is that if you have a known KRAS mutation, she is very unlikely to have either an EGFR or an ALK mutation, and so that may be sufficient information for you not to test for the other two. Secondly, it would indicate to me, at least, that even though she's a never smoker, she would be very unlikely to respond to erlotinib. Whether she would respond to chemotherapy, I think, is another question, and that's not as well answered. And I guess the other reason that the KRAS information might be useful would be if she were interested in participating in a clinical trial, looking at a therapeutic that was specifically meant to inhibit KRAS.
Such as?
I am aware that there have been KRAS inhibitors that have been tested in the past, mostly in the form of farnesyl transferase inhibitors. The RAF kinase inhibitor, sorafenib, would be logical to look at in somebody with a KRAS mutation, since RAF kinase is downstream from KRAS, and presumably a KRAS mutation would mean overactivation of RAF kinase as well. I do believe there are also some KRAS inhibitors that are being studied. I'm not quite as knowledgeable about the specifics of those.
So before we talk about the treatment options right now and how these markers relate to that, maybe just to take a step back a little bit and go back to her initial diagnosis in 2008, when I guess you didn't see her, but if you had seen her, knowing that she had negative lymph nodes and a 1.5 centimeter tumor, and she had said to you, what's the chance I'm going to develop metastatic disease? And would that be reduced by me taking adjuvant chemo? How would you have responded?
Well, because she had a well-differentiated tumor that was small, 1.5 centimeters in size, the data would suggest that her chance for recurrence would be somewhere in the 20% range. The adjuvant trials that have been reported to date do not support the use of adjuvant chemotherapy for stage 1A disease. I think it's worthwhile to consider testing these patients for genetic markers. There are groups that have risk stratified patients based upon gene profiles, and we know 20% of these patients do recur. So if you were to identify a high risk profile, it would be reasonable to test the idea of adjuvant therapy, but I would only do that in the setting of a clinical trial.
Just out of curiosity, and I hate to ask this, put yourself in the position of a healthy 65-year-old woman, knowing that, yes, there's no data that adjuvant therapy for sure would reduce the risk of recurrence, but there's data when it's higher risk and, you know, maybe it makes more sense. Do you think you'd want adjuvant chemo?
What I would want is to look at the available data with high-risk gene markers. There's a group from Taiwan that has a 5-gene model, and I would seek to do that sort of testing. And if I felt like I fit into a higher risk category, I would discuss that with my doctor and ask them to consider adjuvant therapy. Certainly, if I had a KRAS mutation or if I didn't fit the profile of these experimental models, I would not want adjuvant therapy. But that's what I would do for myself.
Out of curiosity, how often do patients facing real tough decisions of any type ask you, what would you do if it were you or somebody in your family?
That happens all the time. And, you know, I think it's a hard question to answer because unless you're in that circumstance, I don't know that you really know how you would answer the question. And we're all in different parts of our lives. My answer when I'm 42 is probably going to be different than when I'm 72. I've got 3 young children. When I'm 72, I'll have grandchildren, and you'll just be in a different part of your life. You may have other medical issues, family dynamics, social dynamics. So it's hard for me to answer for patients because I'm answering as a 42-year-old father of 3 small children.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I find interesting is how often people tell us, both investigators and docs in practice, that patients ask that. I don't know, I kind of found it interesting and not exactly surprising, but maybe a little bit.
Yeah, one of my colleagues, unfortunately, passed away from cancer about 2 years ago. He was a practicing oncologist for 25 years, very beloved at our university. And he said something that was really striking to me as his cancer had metastasized. And that is that from the perspective of he as a patient, he wanted to be far more aggressive than he would have advised his patients had he been seeing himself as a patient.
Yep, interesting. Well, let's get back to this woman's current situation. It's really amazing you present a patient like this and the way you think it through, which I want you to describe. I mean, I think it's been less than 2 years that we would think this case through the way you're thinking it through. But so kind of bring us up to date on EGFR mutations, ALK wild, what it means to a patient like this.
Well, I think clearly if this patient had an EGFR mutation, she would most likely respond to erlotinib, and she would probably have a durable response. She has minimal disease, a 2-year disease-free interval, a good performance status, no weight loss. Frankly, she probably is going to do well for a long time, regardless of what you do. But I think the risk-benefit with erlotinib is worth giving it as chronic maintenance therapy. Obviously, if she has side effects, she could always lower the dose. But that's what I would do if she had an EGFR mutation. If she had an ALK mutation, we and others are going to be opening up a trial looking at chemotherapy with or without crizotinib, which is an ALK inhibitor for those patients who have gene rearrangement of EML4-ALK. And I would certainly offer that as a clinical trial. I think the more challenging question is what to do in her circumstance when she doesn't have an EGFR or an ALK mutation. Again, she feels well. She's not losing weight. She has a performance status of 0. She's got a 2-year disease-free interval. She's got minimal disease. Do we give her chemotherapy? If we give her chemotherapy and she responds, do we give her maintenance therapy? Do we put her on maintenance bevacizumab? Do we put her on switch chemotherapy with maintenance pemetrexed? For her, my perspective is I wouldn't do any of that. I don't think maintenance therapy really makes a lot of sense for her, at least with bevacizumab and with chemotherapy. Again, because she is likely to do well for a long period of time, regardless of what you do. You're probably going to diminish her quality of life for a period of time if you give her chemotherapy. And so my approach to her was that she should get another CT scan in 3 months' time. And if in 3 months' time she has very minimal change, I'm comfortable continuing to watch her. And she may go another year, year and a half without needing any therapy at all. If, on the other hand, in 3 months' time, she has any new clinical symptoms or her disease appears to be a little bit more aggressive than what we had initially thought, then I would initiate therapy. But I would certainly resist the temptation to initiate her on therapy right away, and definitely resist the temptation to give her chronic maintenance therapy.
And when you say initiate therapy, what specifically?
I think there are several regimens which are reasonable. Most physicians are probably using carboplatin with either pemetrexed and bevacizumab or carboplatin and paclitaxel with bevacizumab. Because she has an adenocarcinoma, it would seem as though gemcitabine would be a little inferior to a drug like pemetrexed. Taxanes, in my view, have a bit more toxicity than a drug like pemetrexed. So either is reasonable. If she didn't want bevacizumab for whatever reason, then you would just give her probably carboplatin and pemetrexed.
And what would you be thinking in terms of maintenance or early second-line therapy?
In this particular patient, where I don't think it's at all likely that you're going to miss the opportunity to give her second-line and probably even third-line therapy, I really don't think there is a role for maintenance therapy. Maintenance therapy, I believe, should be considered in those patients in which you are concerned that the patient may miss the opportunity to get second-line therapy. All of the clinical trials that have been reported to date looking at switch maintenance therapy have the flaw in their study design in that the patients on the control arm don't necessarily get the maintenance drug. So these trials are oftentimes testing giving a maintenance drug versus never giving the drug versus giving a maintenance drug now or delayed.
What do you see as the role, if any, of an EGFR TKI like erlotinib in a patient who does not have a mutation, second, third line therapy, any clinical situation?
I certainly think it's reasonable to give those patients the drug as second or third line, sometimes fourth line therapy. It just tells me that it's not the preferred agent first line. If we look at the IPASS data, those patients who were EGFR wild type and never smokers with adenocarcinoma had a significant early drop-off if they received the EGFR inhibitor gefitinib. They had a very rapid progression, and unfortunately, they had a significant number of patients who had early death. That data, to me, supports the use of chemotherapy over an EGFR inhibitor in never smokers if the patient is wild type. Now, if the patient has an EGFR mutation, I think the preponderance of the data does support using an EGFR inhibitor first line, but we don't see the same rapid drop-off in progression-free survival or overall survival in the first 3 months if we give those patients chemotherapy. So I don't think you're wrong to give them chemotherapy frontline. I think a drug like erlotinib is preferred.
While we're talking about EGFR TKIs, can you talk a little bit about the so-called irreversible TKIs, BIBW2992, for example?
Sure. So we know that the drugs erlotinib and gefitinib are reversible EGFR TKI inhibitors. And one of the known mechanisms of resistance to drugs like erlotinib is a change in the conformation of the binding site on the tyrosine kinase. This does confer resistance, and the best described of these is the T790 mutation. It's analogous to what we see with imatinib in CML, in that those patients who develop resistance do so because of a change in the binding site for imatinib. And so the idea behind using irreversible inhibitors is that the drug binds to the TKI, it doesn't drop off, and therefore you should have greater inhibition of the downstream targets.
And what do we know in terms of clinical data on these agents?
Yeah, the BIBW2992, I think, is the furthest along, and it's currently undergoing randomized clinical trials. We know that these drugs are active in patients who have EGFR mutations. The question is, are they going to be more active than drugs like erlotinib? And I don't think we have enough data yet to say one way or another.
I guess one thing that would be an option for this woman if she remains stable would be to be involved in a clinical trial looking at new agents. You talked a little bit about some of the other things. Anything that you're involved with right now or that you've heard about that you think is different or interesting and oncologists might want to hear about?
Well, I think obviously the most exciting area is with crizotinib and the ALK mutation. Unfortunately, that only occurs in 3 to 4% of all patients with lung cancer, although it is seen in 30% of never smokers. There are a number of other drugs that target pathways that we're familiar with. The VEGF receptor pathway is continuing to be targeted in unique ways. A drug like cediranib, which has undergone some study through the NCI Canada, is continuing to be studied, and that is a VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor. There are other pathways that are being looked at. A pathway that seems to be important in small cell lung cancer is the hedgehog pathway. And there's certainly reason to study the hedgehog inhibitors in small cell lung cancer. It also seems to be an activated pathway in other diseases as well. There are a number of targets that we've been talking about for years. Telomerase continues to be an important target that folks are looking at. I think in lung cancer, one of the most important targets is KRAS, and that's the next huge mountain, is how can we find drugs that are active in the 25% of patients who have KRAS mutations?
How about the BLP25 liposome vaccine? Do you know anything about that?
That's an interesting drug. There was a fairly large randomized phase 2 study looking at chemotherapy with or without that agent. This was reported out about 4 years ago. And it didn't appear that patients with metastatic disease benefited from this agent, but it did appear that the subset of patients with stage 3B disease had a significant survival advantage with this agent. And so now there is a very large randomized phase 3 study that's ongoing worldwide looking at this specifically in patients with stage 3 disease.
Do you know anything in terms of the actual mechanism of action? It's a vaccine, right?
Yeah, it targets MUC1, and I'm not an expert on this. I just know that that's its primary target. MUC1 is MUC-1, appears to be an antigen that's important in some tumors.
Okay, let's talk about your second patient, the 75-year-old woman.
So this is a patient that I've been seeing now for a couple years. She was initially diagnosed with locally advanced, unresectable stage 3 adenocarcinoma of the lung. She's now 75 years old. She was diagnosed in 2007. She is of Korean descent, got her initial treatment in California. She's lived in the United States for many decades. And she received concurrent chemo radiation. She got carboplatin paclitaxel and radiation 3 years ago. She had an excellent response, continued to have a radiographic abnormality on her CT scan. And because she was a Korean-American female with the remote smoking history, her physicians in 2007 put her on maintenance or erlotinib after she had finished her chemo radiation. She then moved to be closer to other members of her family, and I began to see her about 2 years ago here in Indiana. She was having tremendous diarrhea and fatigue from her erlotinib, and I really didn't see that there was any good evidence that this patient should be on erlotinib. So I discontinued it, and her diarrhea improved markedly, and she felt better. And she was left with this residual radiographic abnormality on CT scan, which of course could simply be just radiation fibrosis.
Now, was there a possibility that you could have done an EGFR mutation or ALK on her tissue from prior biopsy?
Yeah, and that's the challenge, and one of the reasons why I wanted to discuss this patient is that there was really insufficient tissue from her original diagnosis to test. And I didn't see that as being particularly important at this point because she had had the appropriate therapy and now she was just being followed. Now, about 6 months ago, she started to develop a little bit more of a cough and her CT scan showed a very small change in her mediastinum. And I told her that we would keep an eye on this. 3 months later, there was no change. And then I saw her again 3 months after that. Unfortunately, now her cough has gotten significantly worse, and her CT scan shows a significant increase in the growth of her mediastinal mass. It's clearly in a radiation field, and it's definitely not resectable. And her EGFR and ALK status is unknown. So this is a conundrum that we face a lot in lung cancer that really separates us from many other fields of oncology. And that is the challenge of getting sufficient tissue to do testing for markers. And it's not easy to get tissue on some of these patients. They don't oftentimes have easily palpable superficial masses. Usually requires an invasive biopsy, either the adrenal or the liver or the lung. Bone biopsies don't seem to be terribly helpful in testing for these mutations. You can't oftentimes get a good enough sample that's preserved. So I talked to her about getting additional tissue, and we're planning to do bronchoscopy, something we wouldn't have done in years past, but the idea is to get a core biopsy of the growing mass. And certainly if she has an EGFR or an ALK mutation, that would be the preferred next line of therapy.
You know, it's just going through my head as you were presenting that, you know, in terms of the issue of getting the tissue. And I was thinking, I'm not sure I'd do if it was just EGFR. I could always just give her erlotinib. But, you know, when you really get down to it, you got to get it. I mean, it'd be nice to have EGFR, but you got to get it for ALK.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I tell my staff is if there's only enough tissue to get one test done, get the ALK test done.
Yep. Yeah, amazing. Any speculations about when crizotinib might become available clinically? And right now, is there any way to get it in compassionate use?
Well, we have three protocols with the crizotinib. One is first line, one is second line, and then the third is, it's not really compassionate use, but it's single agent for patients who either were on the second line study and randomized to the chemo arm, or never entered any of the trials because of eligibility issues. Maybe they have had three or four prior therapies, but still meet some basic criteria for safety. And so our patients oftentimes can get a drug like crizotinib. It's clearly very active in the patients with ALK mutations. The hope is that it's not just a transient response, but that there are a subset of patients like there are with erlotinib and EGFR mutations where they have a very durable response.
Any speculations when it might become available?
This is an amazing story because you can trace back many of the advances in cancer to something discovered decades ago. An example of that, of course, is with the VEGF receptor pathway, EGFR, for instance. You know, the epidermal growth factor was first described in 1968. Nobel Prize in Medicine was given to Stanley Cohen for the EGFR receptor pathway in 1986. But ALK really stands separate from that. The first publications from Japan about the importance of ALK in lung cancer were only 3 years ago. And then a very quick phase one study was done that showed significant activity with this agent. Phase two study followed that was highlighted at ASCO in the plenary session, showing that nearly 60% of patients had an objective response. An activation of a worldwide phase three study occurred just a few months later. And I expect that even though this only occurs in 3-4% of patients, it is such an exciting field that there is a great motivation for physicians and patients to get patients on this study, that study will close much sooner than people think, and that hopefully within 6 months to a year we'll have the data, and I hope and expect a rapid approval.
There are a few examples of things out there that you ask oncologists, if you had it, would you use it? And they say, yeah, like, for example, T-DM1 in breast cancer, which they can't get. And I'm starting to think crizotinib needs to be on that list.
I definitely think that as long as they have sufficient data, and I think we're close, if not there already, likely will open it up for compassionate use and should.
Okay, let's talk about your last patient, 53-year-old woman.
Yeah, now this is an interesting patient because this is a never-smoking female with multifocal bronchoalveolar carcinoma who had a spectacular response to erlotinib, But unfortunately, she develops such severe toxicities that it's challenging to give it to her. And so we've tried some dose reductions. And so now the question is, what do we do? How low of a dose does she need? So briefly speaking, she initially presented with bilateral pulmonary nodules. Biopsy was bronchoalveolar carcinoma. She's 53. She's a never smoker. Performance status is zero. Initially, her EGFR status was unknown. So in the patients in whom their status is unknown, I think chemotherapy is the preferred first-line therapy. We gave her carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab, and she did get a partial response with that. She received 4 cycles of the combination, and then she was on maintenance bevacizumab. In the meantime, she was found to have an EGFR mutation while she was on maintenance bevacizumab. There was data that was presented by Vince Miller from the ATLAS trial looking at the combination of bevacizumab and erlotinib versus bevacizumab alone, in which the suggestion was the progression-free interval was longer with the combination, although overall survival wasn't affected. And it's not terribly convincing data to give the combination, but I think it's reasonable to consider it in a select group of patients. And so I chose to do that for this patient. I gave her erlotinib with her bevacizumab, and within about 3 to 4 weeks of starting the erlotinib, she developed a horrendous skin toxicity, including multiple abscesses that occurred on her scalp. We discontinued her erlotinib. We kept her on bevacizumab. We treated her skin reaction. It resolved. And eventually on bevacizumab, she did have progression of disease. Now, at this point, I thought that perhaps it was the combination of the erlotinib and the bevacizumab that resulted in the greater skin toxicity. So I hypothesized that giving her erlotinib alone might be better tolerated. Just to be safe, I started her at a lower dose, 100 milligrams a day instead of 150 milligrams a day. And after about 4 to 6 weeks of therapy, she had a near complete response. She had some skin toxicity, but it seemed to be manageable. We kept her on erlotinib, and unfortunately, after about 4 months, she developed this extreme skin reaction again. And this time, she developed about 12 abscesses on her lower extremity. It was the most extreme reaction I had ever seen. She required multiple surgical debridements and about 3 months' time to heal. Obviously, we discontinued the erlotinib.
Can I just ask you, you know, you gave her a reduced dose of 100 milligrams, but, you know, it's been said that perhaps in patients with mutations, you don't really need as high a dose. Did you think about going even lower?
I did, and perhaps I should have. And I think what you're referring to is that it may be, and preclinical models support this, and our own clinical experience supports this, that patients with the mutation are very sensitive to even lower doses, and maybe 50 milligrams is sufficient for these patients.
I mean, it's always easy to be Monday morning quarterback and stuff after this, but it's just a thought, and I don't know. So what's her current situation?
Well, we gave her pemetrexed, which she had responded to. She progressed. I gave her gemcitabine. She had stable disease for a while. She progressed. She's coughing a little bit more. She's a little bit more short of breath. And now we have to make a decision on whether to give her erlotinib again. And this is a real-life situation. I'm seeing her in a week or two. We've discussed this. She absolutely dreads the idea of getting erlotinib. Unfortunately, I think it's very unlikely that she's going to respond to other chemotherapy agents, and she's always responded very well to erlotinib. She has never progressed on erlotinib. It's just the toxicities that are prohibitive.
Well, maybe you could try her in like 20 milligrams or something once she gets better.
That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, it was such a strange reaction to the drug. And usually the skin reaction is just this typical acneiform-like rash. Patients can get it anywhere in their body, but typically on their face. And it's only severe 5 to 10% of the time and easily reversible. But her skin reaction was so extreme, it was easily the worst reaction I'd ever seen. And I would have thought maybe it wasn't the erlotinib the first time it happened, but then it happened the second time. So I'm going to plan to do what you've said, start her on 25 milligrams, see if she's responding. you know, I'll get another scan in 4 weeks' time. If she's responding to 25 milligrams, there's really no point in going up on the dose. If she has less than a robust response on 25 milligrams, I think it's reasonable to up the dose to at least 50 milligrams before you consider her an erlotinib failure.
It's really a great case. What is new in lung cancer that we haven't talked about so far?
One of the more interesting trials that was presented at ASCO this past year was presented by Dr. Joan Schiller. And this looks at a c-MET inhibitor. And this drug, I'm not sure if it even has name yet, but its initials are ARQ, I think 197. And this is a c-MET inhibitor that combined with erlotinib seemed to have better efficacy compared to erlotinib alone in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. We and others will be participating in a phase 3 trial. And c-MET amplification is seen in about a third of patients who have acquired resistance to drugs like erlotinib. And so logically, we combine a drug that inhibits c-MET with a drug that inhibits EGFR. It appeared to be better in a randomized phase 2 study, obviously needs to be proven in a randomized phase 3 trial. I think that's probably at the forefront of newer drugs, newer classes of drugs that are furthest in development.
This c-MET, is it a oral TKI?
Yes.
What kind of side effects?
You know, amazingly, it has very few side effects. We tested this as a single agent in patients at our center with testicular cancer. Now, unfortunately, it didn't have any activity in testicular cancer, but amazingly, it had no side effects either. So a number of grade 2, grade 3 side effects is virtually zero.